You're listening to Dig Deep on KAXE, KBXE, and in the podcast form. You can also find us on iTunes. I'm Heidi Holton, along with Chuck Marone. He's our conservative commentator from Strong Towns. Aaron Brown, our liberal commentator, Minnesota Brown, among other things that we know you guys from. But thanks for being here today.
Hey,
good to be here.
Very happy to be here.
So this topic we have today kind of comes up in every conversation we have, but now we're going to hone in on it, and that's the rural-urban divide. Do you think people in urban areas talk about rural-urban divide, or is it just rural people that talk about rural-urban divide?
I think it's one of those things that we like to obsess about a little bit, and the conversation resonates with us because I think we feel, in many ways, alienated. It's impossible if you live in a rural area to avoid the urban conversation. It's very easy if you live in an urban area to avoid the rural conversation.
We're at a disadvantage.
Exactly. I think we're, you know, more of the, like, you know, fourth child kind of thing in the family. Like, hey, we're here too.
Yeah.
So I do think it's more of a hang up for us than for them. But I do think, you know, when you have things like elections, which we just went through, when you have the map up on the screen and people are scratching their heads going, why is so much of the country not voting like me? And then you get the whole, maybe we shouldn't be a republic. Maybe we should just be a straight democracy. Or maybe we should distort this map so that it represents population and makes us feel better so that the whole thing isn't red. You know, the blue, it's like areas are bigger. So we have that whole kind of urban conversation to kind of, like, as a way to ignore what's going on here. So yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to it. And I think it's important for us. And I'm glad we're going to chat about it.
Yeah, we'll kind of take it in three parts, but we'll start with kind of the culture of rural-urban divide and how culturally we're different. Or how do you want to start this?
Yeah, I think that'd be great. You want to?
Well, yeah, I just, one of the observations I always make, I think I've made versions of it before, is the act of driving from my house in Balsam Township, Itasca County, Minnesota, to downtown Minneapolis is a true and profound change. I mean, you are, it's almost like being on a different planet, because I'm leaving a place where I live on a dirt road, haul my own garbage to the dump. If a tree goes down, I have to remove it. If I have to mow my own lawn, and even just the act of getting people to help me on these everyday tasks, it can be done, but it's unaffordable for people, for normal working people. So you do all this stuff yourself, and you are isolated in an area where you don't go out to the theater and you don't pick up a coffee at the coffee shop. You brew it in your pot, and that's just what life is like. And then you drive through, you know, changes, small towns along the way, and you go past Duluth, which is this mid-sized city you know a little bit about. But by the time you get through the puncture, the exurbs and suburbs of the city, you're listening to different radio, you're watching the billboards, you're looking at another world where different things matter more than things that you think are important. And you look at the different cars, the people in the cars, and you're seeing different kinds of people you don't normally see.
The bumper stickers.
The bumper stickers.
Yeah.
But it's also the billboards and the things that are being sold. The goods and services being sold suddenly are very different. The tone. And then you get into the city and you're walking around and you're listening. I like to listen to conversations just for the tempo and the language. And people are just not talking about the same things that we talk about and that you hear at the cafes in northern Minnesota. And that's not a bad thing. I'm not saying like, oh, they're bad and we're good, or we're good and they're bad. It's more about just, it's hard for people to understand each other when they speak a different language.
Very different.
Yeah.
I had a coworker once who is a very urban, she lived down in Uptown and lived there her whole life and had been up, to greater Minnesota once as a kid. She was driving up for a meeting, driving up to the Brainerd Lakes area. And she actually asked me before, should I stop and get gas? And I'm like, what? Okay, do you need gas? And she goes, well, is there any place to get gas?
Yeah.
And I'm like, every 3 miles.
In Brainerd, Brainerd has,
like,
gas.
Yeah, like the whole way up. But this same person once, I was sitting out on my porch and we were having a phone call. Someone near me was sighting in a rifle or something. There was a series of gunshots for whatever reason, which was not uncommon. I mean, this happens all the time and what have you. And I asked her, because I had on my hands-free thing, I said, can you hear that? And she said, what? And I said, you hear the gunshots. And she's like, oh my gosh, are you okay? Do you need me to call somebody? And I'm like, what are you talking about? Mm-hmm. Like, what do you mean? And it kind of reinforced this notion that we do live in very different worlds of very different places. And I think sometimes we forget that too.
Yeah, we do.
Like I said, it's more acute, I think, because they can pretend that we don't exist, and the opposite is not possible.
And pop culture, or, you know, TV shows, movies show urban areas. So I feel like we have a little more understanding.
Unless as a gag. If they show rural areas, it's as a joke or a gag, right?
Yeah, and there's a lot more stereotype, mostly because, and you can kind of hear it, as a writer, and I write comedy and I write some thematic things, and so I can hear the writer's room when I watch like a national television show, a drama or something like Grey's Anatomy. Just, I don't watch Grey's Anatomy. My wife watches Grey's Anatomy and I'm just in the same room. But anyway,
wow.
I'm making an admission here.
Yeah, I've never seen that face on him before.
Oh, I was just like, oh, I just admitted that. Anyway, Grey's Anatomy is a good example. It's basically a soap opera. It's set in a city, Seattle. And they reference sometimes rural America. They had a character on a few years ago. She just left the show, but that she was from rural Wisconsin. And she was the Christian and the conservative. And they kind of just took this character's stereotype and then twisted it kind of so that it never really truly represented, I think, what people of that description really sound like or think like. And she wasn't a bad character. It's just they didn't understand it. It's clear they didn't understand it when they were writing it. And how everybody else reacted to it was kind of like from a very, you know, fixed urban secular point of view. So it's really hard. Right. You know, they were trying to have, oh, we understand, you know, Christian conservatives and we have a character. See, and that's how they handle a lot of problems on that show. That, oh, we'll represent this social problem with a character who has these characteristics that, you know, then we can then use that as a stand-in for some hot issue. And it usually doesn't work very well. But you can see how, you know, the producers, the writers, the directors come from a point of view of like LA, New York, the entertainment capitals, lovely places, you know, interesting, fascinating places, huge cities, lots, millions of people. And so it's not bad that entertainment comes from these places, but it's just really hard. It'd be like me sitting in Balsam Township trying to write the New York.
Something that would be relevant to someone living in a penthouse.
The urban beat column for New York City. Like, obviously, I'm in no position to do that. And that's the disadvantage, though, is they essentially get to do that for us, and we don't get to do that for them.
I think one of the interesting things in the last couple of years that I've read, because obviously, the media has been struggling with this. I mean, I think the 2016 election freaked everybody out because they're like, we don't even know these people. You know, David Brooks, columnist, conservative columnist for the New York Times, is like, I need to get to know America. I clearly don't know them. I think that was a general, like, pervasive thing. The Harvard Business Review does a podcast, and they actually had a really interesting episode where they tried to delve into this. One of the things that they brought up was just the difference in kind of family and living arrangements and how that kind of forces all these subtle cultural changes. So let me give you an example. Got a really good friend, lives in Long Island now. He used to live in Queens. Had a baby the same time we had our kids. He had a au pair. He had, you know, this like daycare. They would, you know, take their kid in an Uber to drop them off here. They had all these like urban support systems that basically their money and affluence purchased for them. Mm-hmm. So my wife is going to go do hot yoga, whatever, whatever. And so we bring the kid over here and then pay someone to watch them here. And when I looked at like our life, and I'm not saying we're poor, we're certainly doing better, but I even look at like the people around us who had kids at the same time, you rely on mom and dad, mm-hmm. grandpa and grandma, brothers and sisters, other people in the family to watch your kids, to help out, to fill these gaps. Because you do, you have a certain, and I'm going to use like their words, you have a certain oppressive like social structure that creeps in. If I'm going to ask my mom and my dad to watch my kid, it's pretty hard for me to say, take your guns and religion and stick them you know where. You know, I got to be like at least respectful of their viewpoints in a way that you don't have to when you don't have those relationships. It forces a certain kind of like cultural conformity And I'm not saying like an absolute, you know, it's not despotic, but there's certainly more, I think we call these sometimes the small town values. There's a certain bit of, we don't want to do that. You don't want to get too far out, you know, this way or that, because you have more reliance on your immediate family, your immediate neighbors, the people around you, just by like the nature of how our society's structured here. There's a friend of mine who has recently moved to the Brainerd Lakes area, a very nice person, but she's been posting on social media about her difficulties getting an au pair. She comes from a different culture. And I'm like, you know, I get what you're saying. And like, I understand and you're communicating with people back from your place, but like nobody around here has an au pair. Like nobody in the Brainerd Lakes area is having these struggles. And I realize that you
better
are.
Start calling her a nanny or you're going to have real trouble.
You better use some different language because like culturally you're not really connecting with people here. Do you see what I'm saying?
I absolutely see that. And I think one of the cultural divides before we get into talking about politics is the notion of what are we anxious about? What are we thinking about? And that kind of starts from the choices we make. Who really wants to live in a rural area? Who among my classmates really chose to stay here and why did they choose to do so? It was either things they liked to do. In other words, they liked to hunt and fish and be outside. They liked to ride snowmobiles and four-wheelers wherever they wanted to go, shoot guns whenever they wanted to. My dad always used to say he didn't want to live anywhere where he couldn't shoot something off his porch. I mean, he talked about this all the time when I was growing up. And the irony is, well, he actually does now. He lived in South St. Paul, and he couldn't do that for a period of his life. Now he lives back in Chisago County, where that sort of thing is more common. But I always thought that was kind of backward, and now I don't have a gun, but I could do it where I live, too. But that was kind of this idea of this freedom, and you choose to live there. And then the other reason people chose to stay, even if they didn't like any of those things, was for their own family. For the sake of their parents and grandparents, and they wanted to bring their kids up near their parents. And that structure that you just described, having mom, like I live next to my in-laws.
Right.
Right next door, well, 0.2 miles, we can see their lights maybe through the winter trees. But that was part of, we made the commitment to live next to them, not only so they could help us with our kids, but so that we could help them as they get older. Right. This is a contract, a social contract we've engaged in that is lifelong. And in fact, we have direct orders from my father-in-law to keep the land that was his land, his family's land that we built on and they built on, to keep the land together and pass it down to future generations. We have a primitive fiefdom in the woods, or not a primitive, but like, a latter day version of a landed gentry going on out there. Granted, we don't have our own army or anything, but it's a very different way of looking at life because I could chase jobs around the country. I could move to LA and be a screenwriter, but that would then violate this contract that we have and that we don't want to violate, you know? Right. So people stay for that reason. And part of the consequence that I see from that is that then there's the great distrust or anxiety about what's going on outside of this world and things that might threaten this social contract, the things we love to do, the way we love to do them. And so when you look culturally, that when you have that kind of fear of those urban areas that people just don't understand this, they don't understand this way of thinking, you see why a lot of messages that appeal to those fears are so successful in rural areas. The flip side is, why do people move to the city? Why do people live in urban areas? And they tend to look more at the energy and active turnover that a city provides, new people, new ideas, new things, constant change. And change means opportunity. So if you're an opportunist or somebody who's interested in growing a career, your number of opportunities in a city are much higher, which is why cities attract people who are attracted to that sort of thing. And that includes, like you described, I have a friend, a guy I'm working with who lives in Queens, just like you described, and he's told me how much he pays for daycare. And it's insane.
It's bizarre.
It's insane. Like, right. I don't understand it. But he has this big thing. He, like your friend, he could have moved out of the city when they had kids, but they're trying to raise them in the city, and that's a challenge. They're trying to prove something by doing that. So the consequence of living in the urban environment is what I saw out in San Francisco when I went out there, which is I was in the most wealthiest part of America. I was in the heart of Silicon Valley, the Apple, the Stanford University, that whole region. And I was meeting and talking to people from that area. And I was struck by one of the biggest things that was different was how much of their lives were based on electrons. You know, things that weren't necessarily real, but that were making them money somehow. Even though one guy told me he could retire in his early 40s, and the way he got it was working for a series of big companies that never made a profit. They never made a profit, and yet he's making money because there's so much investment. He gets all of his products and food and meals and services like is made, and they all come to his house. Because he orders them through his phone,
right.
Which in San Francisco you can do because almost anything you can get done via an app, you know, so you can get picked up, dropped off,
I travel a ton, and yeah. I've actually gotten, Uber Eats is incredible.
Yeah.
It's, you know, you go to a hotel and you order room service. Why order room service from the junky hotel menu? Just go on Uber Eats and they'll bring you whatever you want from whatever restaurant you want with like hardly any service charge. I've had friends get off the plane here in Brainerd and say, well, I'll just Uber over to your house. And I'm like, seriously? Because that's not going to happen.
Yeah. You're going to get the, well, I shouldn't make fun of a company, but there's an Iron Range town that has a taxi company that is just an old four-door 1989 sedan with a magnetic sticker on the side that says taxi service.
Yeah.
And that's your Uber. Uh-huh. You know.
I do think that this is very real and it comes from two very different lifestyles. And I think if it just stopped there, like if it just, this is the lifestyle I want, that's the lifestyle you want, I think it would be pretty benign. I mean, you could actually go back and forth because there's a lot of thing about big cities that I love, like I find just wonderful. And there's a lot about living in a small town that really fits me and is just very delightful. I think if it just ended there, we could all have, you know, what we wanted.
There's pros and cons to both.
Exactly.
Leave it at that. Yeah.
But it doesn't end there. It gets much deeper and it crosses over into many different things. And now I think with the way that our population has sorted itself, which is something, you know, we've talked about here before, but really over the last 50, 60 years, in ways that humanity has never experienced before, we have been able to pick up, move on a whim and sort ourselves in ways that have taken, I think, the normal human divides and magnified them. You used to have small towns where you had progressive liberal people who were open to experience and change living right alongside of conservative people who were more hierarchical in their thinking and enjoyed a different, more modest kind of lifestyle. You used to have them living together in small towns. And now what has largely happened is that the people with high an openness to change and experience, they move to some place where they can get that experience. Mm-hmm. And the people who are, you know, the opposite side of the spectrum, they tend to move to more rural small town places. And so we've become a society, not just bifurcated, not just split apart, but actually to the point now where we don't even know how to talk to the other. There's no mm-hmm. understanding of the other beyond like that is bad.
And I think too, we're watching what's happening is we're a young nation. If you really think about it, we've gone from where a lot of these small towns had kind of a pioneer mindset that endured several generations. And now we're so far out of that, that we're not that anymore. And we're dealing with the fact that that brought, like I'm doing, oh God, here I go again with Hibbing history, but I'm researching Hibbing history, and early Hibbing history was the story of these folks who came here when the city was founded. It was all about bringing, they wanted it to be like San Francisco. They wanted the cosmopolitan touch. It was progress and higher thinking, and they carved these, you were there in Hibbing when did the Great Northern Radio Show. The presidents and philosophers and poets were, busts of them were put up on
You look at these old, I remember the old Paramount Theater in Brainerd, and it had all this like ornamental work along it, and it was an attempt to be cosmopolitan. Yeah. We want to be like the great opera house somewhere, just a smaller version.
And there was an ambition that these rural folks who worked in the fields and farmed, the children of farmers and miners and these folks, would aspire to bring this cosmopolitan not urban, but cultured environment to their town and therefore, you know, share it with others. And even when like an early television history, the thought was that television would be this great equalizer that the common man or woman could watch an educational program and become enlightened out on the farm.
Work in the fields by day and then learn Greek at night.
And you know what? Yeah. And there was more of that did actually happen as a result of that being a cultural value. But as that went by and people realized, well, I can learn philosophy out on the farm, but it's not going to bring my crop in, you know, or it's not going to, I'd rather just go hunting and fishing when I have some free time because I enjoy those activities. And that kind of thing becomes kind of, well, maybe we don't need to do that. Or those who really dig it realize, well, if I want to be a big time philosophy major, I really probably should leave this tiny little town and go somewhere where there's a job for me to be a philosophy major. So as that sorting, as you pointed out, happened, you know, now we're seeing a lot of that change, and we're dealing with that not just here in northern Minnesota, but really across the country. And I think that's one of the pressures. It's a cultural pressure as much as it is a political one. It manifests politically, but it's a cultural pressure.
Well, we will go into politics and the rural-urban divide in the next segment of Dig Deep. You can hear it coming up Wednesday morning at 8:10. Dig Deep is made possible in part by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota.